This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We're meeting on April 2nd, 1987 at 3 o'clock p.m. in hearing room 343. This will be a work session on Senate Bills 20 and 21 and a public hearing on Senate Bills 114, 118, 219, 356, 493, 497, and 502.
Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Senators Brenham and Frye are a subcommittee to hear public testimony. We'll start with Senate Bill 356. Frank Bronner, is he here yet? Well, I guess he's not interested in this bill. I've got four witnesses signed up: Kenneth Ryder, Frank Bronner, Michael Scott, and Jack Kalinowski. I don't care who comes first. Is there any coordination on this? Okay. Come on up.
Sure. Mike Scott, a lawyer from Tigard with Fur and Scott, and I represent the Construction Industry Committee. We have provided some written testimony, and I also come with a dual hat today, and I'm a member of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, and there's a letter from Eric Yandell that indicates that the bar opposes the bill. I also indicate in our written testimony that the Construction Industry Committee opposes the bill, but that's not the real reason I'm here. The real reason I'm here is to ask Frank Bronner to come up and sit down next to me if he can so we can get this resolved, which is what we've been trying to do. Is the Construction Industry Committee has met with the Oregon Bankers Association and are in the process of working out proposed amendment to the bill that would resolve the deep concerns that we have with it. The bill generally returns the lien time under 87035 to that prior, which was effective prior to September 20th, 1985. We're concerned with having the law one way in 85, changing it in 85 through 87, going back to where we were. The bankers have some concerns with the law that was changed in 85, and we're attempting to resolve those, and hopefully we'll have proposed amendments to the bill by next week.
You want to add anything to that, Frank?
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, Frank Brown with the Oregon Bankers Association. Obviously, Senator, I was with you the last hour while they were meeting to work out. I've been briefed. This bill is an important bill. Soon after the sine die of the last session, we discovered that without being able to determine accurately the time of completion, the title companies would begin putting exceptions into their policies. We also have discovered during the interim that 90 days is too long to meet the commitment that we must make in the secondary market, and consumers are harmed when we cannot make that commitment. I understand that we're well on our way to compromise proposals for your consideration, and look forward to that.
All right. Fine. Any questions? Senator Brennan, no questions. All right. Does Mr. Ryder? Come on up.
Good afternoon. My name is Ken Ryder, and I'm legal counsel for Key Title Company that's located here in Salem. And I didn't know anything about a compromise, you know, being struck with regard to the bill. My concern as being a representative of the title company is that the unlimited language of the legislation that was changed in 1985 just creates a real nightmare for us as title companies when we're trying to ensure title to property, particularly on what's called an early issue extended coverage mortgagee's policy, through which we are ensuring the lender or the mortgagee that the property is going to be insured free and clear of any prospective construction liens that will be recorded against the property. In the way that the bill was changed, or the statute was changed back in 1985, through which a contractor could file a lien any time within 90 days after the end of his or her construction or improvement on the dwelling unit, then we were just left wide open with, well, we've got to put some kind of a stop on when the contractor must file some sort of a lien. And the way that the statute was changed back in 1985, there essentially was no change. There was no limit. The contractor could place the lien against the property any time within 90 days of the date that he or she completed construction. Well, we just really don't know what that means, and there was no deadline set. If an electrician went in there, did a major bit of work in June, and then went back in September to put a switchplate cover on, well, has he really completed the work on the project until he's actually put that switchplate cover on in September? And so where does our clock start running from the 90 days? And so it was our belief that there has to be some sort of a limit by which the contractor must file a construction lien. So as the bill was phrased, and it does go back to the way the statute was prior to September of 1985, we were in favor of having some sort of a limitation placed on the date by which the contractor must file a lien against the property. If there's some sort of a compromise being struck, then I'd sure like to know about that and be able to voice an opinion as to the compromise.
Yeah, right. Well, now, Mr. Scott, do you see any problem in having Mr. Ryder give you some input on his concerns here?
None at all. The concern that we have here is there was some language that was taken out, and I've explained this to the council for the majority of the title companies in Oregon. I apologize for not having talked to Mr. Ryder about what ceasing to provide and what substantial completion means and legislative intent behind those. We'd be happy to include Mr. Ryder and members of all the title companies in providing the proposed amendments for them to take a look at to address their concerns as well.
All right, if you do that. Mr. Bronner, you don't have any problem with that either. Jack, any problem with that? You want to say anything else?
No, that's fine, thank you.
Jack, did you want to say anything else or not?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jack Kalinowski with the Associated General Contractors. Mr. Chairman, Senator Brenneman prepared an amendment to Senate Bill 356 at my request. It's 356-1. It is an amendment which would have the effect of saying that those who are required to file a notice of right to lien on a commercial improvement must also give a copy of that notice of right to lien to the prime contractor as well as the owner of the land. This, Mr. Chairman, in all honesty, is in a bill that is pending over on the House side. We're asking for this at this time simply because I am afraid that the April 17 deadline for hearing House bills is going to come and pass and this bill is not going to be heard. I would appreciate it if this bill could be amended into this one. Mr. Bronner has given his approval, and then it could be subject to your work session.
I think I would suggest that you be here at the next work session when we get this compromise package put together and give us the explanation on that. All right? Senator Cohen, did you have any questions?
No, that's fine. We don't have enough votes here right now, and I think that's a reasonable way to go. I don't have any problem with putting it in, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any witnesses who haven't signed up on Senate Bill 356 who want to testify? Okay. Public hearing is closed on 356. And let's take a look at Senate Bill 114. Fred Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Fred Hansen, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. With me is Stan Viles, who also deals a lot with our legislative activity. Senate Bill 114 is a true housekeeping measure. I know that term is oftentimes used abusively, but in this case I think it applies. It appears that when previously approved legislation was codified, a critical statutory reference was not added. As a result, violations intended to be subject to civil penalty are not. Under ORS 164-785, it is unlawful for anyone to place offensive substances on land or in water, and it is unlawful for a property owner to allow such substances to remain on the property. DEQ has used that statute for many years to address certain pollution problems, and especially where a property owner refuses to remove waste, sewage, or other polluting materials. During 1986, a contested case civil penalty hearing regarding a property owner's failure to remove a large pile of wood waste, the hearing officer found the violation occurred, but the violator was not liable for a civil penalty. Most of the environmental laws of this state, no matter where they are codified in the Oregon Revised Statutes, describe the violation, which are covered, but reference a general provision of our statute to detail the civil penalty which may be incurred. Our general civil penalty authority is contained in ORS 468-140. In this case, what happened was that the language detailing the violation to be covered, that is, that which appeared in ORS 164-785, states that, quote, the civil penalty authorized by ORS 468-140 may be imposed for violations of this section, close quote. However, ORS 164-785 is not listed under ORS 468-140 and thereby allowing a civil penalty to be assessed. It appears that these two statutes were inadvertently not linked. SB 114 resolves this problem by adding a reference to ORS 164-785 to the list of other statutes for which a civil penalty is authorized under 468-140. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Hanson? All right. Thank you. Anybody want to act on this?
Sure, I'd move it.
All right.
Do we have anybody else signed up?
No. There's no one else signed up. Is there any reason to bring this back at a later work session, or shall we take care of it now? Senator Brenneman, are you inclined to...
No, no problem.
Senator Wires?
No. I'd like to ask if we could have a roll call. I'm going to
sure.
vote aye.
Yeah, we'll have a roll call, as we do on every vote.
I've had some people asking me this morning what we voted on some things last night, so I'd like to urge a roll call.
Well, we get a roll call in this committee on every vote on a bill. It always has been that way and always will be that way. Senator Cohen has moved Senate Bill 114 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Hill.
Wires.
Aye.
Fry. Aye.
Okay.
Why don't
you do 118?
Yes. All right. Stay right there, gentlemen. We'll take up Senate Bill 118.
Thank you. Again, for the record, I'm Fred Hanson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. The purpose of Senate Bill 118 is simple but important. It would allow the Environmental Quality Commission to consider a broader range of factors in determining the appropriate amount of a civil penalty for environmental violations. ORS 468-130 presently provides only three factors that the Commission must consider. These are, number one, past history of the person incurring the penalty and taking feasible steps necessary or appropriate to correct any violation. Two, any prior violations of statutes, rules, orders, and permits pertaining to the pollution control or waste disposal. And three, the economic condition of the person incurring the penalty. While these factors are relevant, they are extremely limiting and may not be the only relevant or important factors. For example, our current administrative rules also allow for consideration of several other factors, including, one, the gravity and magnitude of the violation, two, whether the violation was repeated or continuous, three, whether the cause of the violation was unavoidable accident or negligence or an intentional act, four, whether the violator's cooperativeness and effort to correct the violation. We think these factors are as important, if not more important, than the three factors listed in the statute. However, the Attorney General's office advises us that the present statutory language may not allow for consideration of these other factors. Thus, the immediate effect of Senate Bill 118 would simply be to validate an administrative rule which is already in place and which we believe makes good sense. It is important to note that Senate Bill 118 would not necessarily make the amount of civil penalties either higher or lower. Rather, it will simply allow the agency a broader range of considerations in determining what is fair and appropriate in any particular case. In sum, Senate Bill 118 would improve the fairness of the civil penalty process by allowing the agency to consider a broader range of factors in setting the amount of penalties. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
My question is whether you would have the authority to impose a civil penalty for an act or based upon a consideration that is not set forth in the statute. Adding these words at least, I suppose, would expand the authority to levy civil penalties without limitation, wouldn't it? Is that constitutional?
Mr. Chairman, we are not able to assess any civil penalty for which we do not have specific statutory authority. All this would do would be, when we had that statutory authority, provide us the range of factors to consider when determining the amount of the civil penalty already authorized. This would not grant any additional authority to impose civil penalties where we would not previously, only to take into account additional factors mitigating or aggravating at the time of a violation and determine the amount of that penalty.
Yeah, I understand that. But I am concerned whether it's legal to just kind of let you decide what other factors should be considered in levying a civil penalty. There's something about that that doesn't quite fit.
Chairman, my only response is that this was language that was proposed by who we must listen to as our attorney, and that is the Attorney General's office. Clearly, the language that we have in the existing rule is the type of requirement that we would have. We would expect to be able to consider if it's more appropriate to consider some of those within the statute itself. That certainly could be done. But what we're concerned about is being limited to factors that we don't think necessarily characterize the major aggravating and mitigating factors for that, for a particular penalty.
Again, I understand the rationale for the request to change here. I may be in error in even thinking that this may be a legal problem. Anybody else got any thoughts on that? I'd kind of like to take a look at that question, have staff take a look at that question, I believe.
Fine.
You might, I tell you, would it be helpful now, if you know what my concern is.
I do.
Would you have the Assistant Attorney General write a letter to the staff addressing that point?
We will have that particular issue addressed by the Attorney General. As I indicated before, as they had relayed this, that they felt that this was satisfactory, but without necessarily addressing that issue explicitly.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Any questions of Mr. Hansen? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
What was the...
I guess I'll ask you later what it was you wanted to look at, rather than take time. I can learn about that in a minute. I was talking to the staff about something else, but I can find out later. Thank you.
Now, let's see. Senator Hill still, I think, still tied up in the business committee. So, Senator Riles, I'm kind of waiting for Senator Hill to get here is the reason we're not going into a work session on these other bills. Senate Bill 219. And we have two witnesses signed up. Let's see, who sponsors this bill? All right, Larry Thompson, then. I'll call first.
Larry Thompson, Mr. Chairman, Assistant Attorney General. As you know, the public records law provides two types of exemptions from disclosure. One's unconditional. The other type of exemption has a balancing test, and records are not exempt if the public interest requires disclosure in a particular instance. Based on our experience in interpreting the public records law for our clients and in performing the Attorney General's statutory role of ruling on petitions to review denial of requests to inspect state public records, we've concluded there are some problem areas that should be considered by the Legislative Assembly. These are embodied in Senate Bill 219, which proposes five new conditional exemptions and broadens the trade secret and testing procedure conditional exemptions currently in the bill, or in the statute. The bill also asks for additional time for the Attorney General to review petitions to inspect public records by persons who have been denied that right. The statute currently reads 7 days, and we propose that to be changed to 7 business days. Each of the new or amended conditional exemption proposals is based on an actual case in our office or concern of a client. A representative of the state system of higher education will also testify today in support of at least one of the conditional exemptions proposed to be added, and I understand he'll offer a clarification amendment. We've assisted in drafting the amendment and have no objection to it. I believe the Attorney General and the Department of Justice have a generally good record in administering the public records law in the spirit that it was enacted by the Legislative Assembly. I do have to be candid, though, and say that it is often both difficult and frustrating, and the variety of questions presented to us, either through formal petitions or informal inquiries, are surprisingly varied and complex. Because of that, and in order to ensure consistency, we've assigned special counsel to the Attorney General, currently Jim Mountain, the function of coordinating public record issues. Our proposed amendments to to the statute also include a proposal to delete the specific listing of individual Oregon revised statute provisions outside of ORS Chapter 192, which prohibit, restrict, or otherwise protect public records, and substituting, therefore, just the phrase Oregon law. We found problems with the current listing, believe it to be incomplete, among other things, and have proposed a simpler approach. Very generally and in conclusion, the proposed five new conditional exemptions are: one, information on building security features where disclosure would create a security risk; two, public school research notes; three, public body computer programs; four, public meeting executive session records where disclosure might frustrate the purposes of the executive session; and five, names, addresses, and other information likely to disclose the identity of constituents corresponding with elected officials.
Say that in a word.
It's on line 38-3.
I see. Is that in your prepared?
I'm just looking at the bill.
I see, yeah, okay.
The first four, I think, are generally self-explanatory. The fifth arose out of some of the records requests made by the Roshnishis to different elected officials who had serious concern about the reaction of the Roshnishis if the names and addresses were released. And that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Coleman.
What happened? Have you looked at the Uniform Trade Secrets Law that's being proposed, and does that have any effect on any of these issues that you're planning?
I did, Senator. We were concerned that maybe we should have at least the same definition for trade secret proposed, and the attorney that looked at that for me works with our Tort Claims Act, and his feeling was that first, the Uniform Trade Secrets proposal is a uniform act, and second, that it has different purposes than we have here, and that there would really be nothing to be achieved from having the same definition.
Mr. Chairman, you misunderstand me. I asked you if there was, I wanted to know if you'd looked at it and if there was a need for, there's still a need for at least one or two of these items, and number three, whether there is any, you know, secondly, whether there'd be any kind of conflict or whether in the trade secret piece of all of this, the Uniform Act would allow more to come forward. If we adopted that and didn't change anything here,
I don't think there would be a problem between the two. And we prefer a liberal definition here because we have the balancing test of the public interest. As I say, it's conditional exemption in any event. The reason we've broadened it is to try to bring in some of the public activities that are limited by the rather narrow definition now. Some of the proprietary aspects of the universities or state agencies.
Any further questions, Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Hamby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Historically, I recall, it's another deja vu. This has been through the Senate before. How many times? The research notes, the computer program, Roshnishis are new, but...
It's not exactly the same bill, but my file goes back two sessions.
We've made minor changes. Did it ever clear either chamber?
I don't think it did. I was not involved, and I've looked at the file quickly, but I don't think it got out of committee either time.
Senator Wires, do you recall whether this bill got out of this committee last session? I know we considered it.
I don't think it did, and the session before that we considered it. I don't think it got out of committee then either, but I wouldn't swear to it.
I just remember having lots of discussions about it in detail.
The research notes, the academic...
Well, I'd like... Tell me again now about making confidential the names, addresses, and other information likely to disclose the identity of constituents that write letters to me.
I guess maybe you could say there's a whistleblower aspect to that, among other things. So the Roshnishi, I think, maybe is a little different here. There was some concern on the part, I think it was, as I recall, Superintendent of Public Instruction Duncan, that by releasing some of those names, that those persons might then find themselves named in lawsuits the next day in circuit court, or at least be apprehensive. And so he wanted to protect those, and I think we had similar questions asked by the Secretary of State. I wasn't personally involved, so I don't remember in what context, but both of those were within in connection with Roshnishi's. I gave that just as an example. Again, we're talking about conditional exemption, and if public interest doesn't support it, and the burden would be on the public official to say that. And it wouldn't be our call in either the Attorney General's office or the District Attorney's office, because the elected official appeals would go to the circuit courts.
Any other questions, Mr. Thompson? Okay. Do we have some more testimony?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is George Keller, Vice President for Research, Graduate Studies, and International Programs at Oregon State University. I've been asked by the Chancellor to come and testify on one section of this bill, and I speak also for my colleague, Dr. John Mosley, Vice President of Research, University of Oregon. I think you have in your packet the proposed amendment to the bill, page 3, lines 32, 33 being deleted and substituting following. Do you have that?
Yes.
Okay, then I won't read that. The problem we have, of course, if there is a problem, to date, to my knowledge, we have not had a problem with having to disclose the data of our researchers. But should that happen, I think it can be appreciated that the extent of that and the ramifications of that would be rather severe for any of our institutions of higher education in the attempt to carry out serious research. When you consider the time and effort that a faculty member puts into a project, the dollars that go into it, and should that then be divulged ahead of an appropriate time, because someone can call up the request, obviously that person would not be able to carry out his or her research, would not gain the peer recognition, which is important for promotion in a business such as higher education. Any unethical scooping, essentially, of that person's ideas. I think it would probably only happen one time, and we certainly would lose that faculty member, if not many others, if that were the state policy. You can imagine the difficulty we would have in hiring quality faculty if it were known that here in this state this sort of thing could happen. There's also a hazard in the releasing of raw data, in the sense that it may not have been evaluated. The data in itself may be quite accurate of the tests that have been performed, but the sample, for example, may have a bias to it. It may not have been collected appropriately. Until this is studied by the person fundamentally that has collected it, and that person is the one that can really make the assessment, those data could then be released and all sorts of false interpretations come out from that. And that would cause serious havoc with the wrong kind of data getting out on the street. Now, in higher education, I think you all know that we require our faculty to publish, or they don't get promoted. That in itself is a guarantee that the results of their research will be made public. We do not carry out any classified research in any of our institutions here in the state system of higher education, at least not to my knowledge and not at my institution. And so there is some assurance that the results of their research will become public. There are also cases where we carry out research dealing with the human subjects. In some cases, it's mainly a series of questionnaires that we issue and deals with some of their private lives and this sort of thing. Should this information be divulged in the raw sense, again, you would jeopardize that kind of a program and the privacy of those people. And we would not only be able to do that one time, I'm sure. We also have a considerable amount of collaborative research with industry. At Oregon State University, at this time, it amounts to about $5 million a year. In order to work with industry, and of course we all realize that industry is here to make a profit and to get an edge on the market, there is frequently an exchange of proprietary information, particularly from the company into the institution as it begins to carry out its research. We are by contract bound not to divulge that information. However, our faculty are still bound to publish. If, however, that data were giving up ahead of time, before publication, in release to a Public Information Act or something of that nature, you would imagine that industry would no longer collaborate with any of our institutions. What we do in the sense of holding on to data is that we will deter the publication of a paper, perhaps 3, maximum 6 months, in order to seek a patent where one is appropriate. And that's the extent of withholding information from the public. Years ago, I was concerned with my own program when I came. I'm an oceanographer. I came on the beach, and I had been warned ahead of time that a private citizen wanted copies of all my records within hours that they had been taken. I probably would have scuttled them over the side, and that would have meant at least $500,000 thrown away. That sort of thing scares us from time to time. Right now, the greatest scare that we have is when people call and want to request copies of proposals that our faculty members have made, particularly in dealing with the protocols of using laboratory animals. Thus far, we have not released that types of information. Proposals are those things that are made ahead of being funded. Once things are funded, they become public record, and then they are allowed to be public. But even the National Science Foundation will not release proposals because those are concepts put forth by the people in.